Thanks so much. I should add that I now have a real job, but I was a student for 10 years, which is outrageously a long time. I address the question, where is God in the age of science? I can tell you the answer I used to give, or would have given, aged 18, going up to read natural sciences at Cambridge. I would have said, nowhere. I mean, come and grow up. We've made huge advances in science. It's time to throw off this naive and superstitious belief in a divine maker in the sky. In fact, such was my contempt for Christianity that I wrote a poem to express my feelings about it. Now, you need to understand that I was a science student, not a literature student, and my poem isn't very good, but I can still remember it, and it went like this. Some folk seem to find it odd that people grow from tiny cells. Pathetic, those who think of God and still drop coins in wishing wells. There we are. That was my contribution to the canon of English poetry. I thought, yeah, I mean, sure, people used to believe that God made it rain with a giant watering can in the sky. But now we've figured out evaporation and condensation, the water cycle. People used to think that you got ill because of evil spirits and you got better because of miracles. But then we came to understand about bacteria and viruses and immunoglobulin and so on. Surely nowadays, now we've sequenced the human genome, now we've put people on the moon, it's time to grow up and to throw off these superstitious, backward, middle-aged ideas. About 2 months after writing that poem, I became a Christian, and everything in my life changed, including my attempt to write poetry. I haven't got any poetry as a Christian, you'll be pleased to know. But long story, and I could tell you more later if you want to ask in question time. But basically, I met Christians at university who didn't fit my stereotype of religious people. I thought that Christians were gullible hypocrites. I wasn't rude enough to say that to their face, but that's what I thought. I thought they're gullible because I've never heard anyone give me a serious reason why I should believe it. And I thought they were hypocrites because I knew as well as you do the scandals about the paedophile priests and the embezzling of church funds, etc. I thought there's nothing to this. I met people at university who were Christians, and they weren't either of those things. They weren't gullible. Some of them much, much cleverer than me. And we thought through reasons for why they believe what they believe. I've never encountered that before. And they weren't hypocrites. They sought to live out the teaching of Jesus Christ in a way that was very radical and very startling to me. And I engaged with them, and I went to talks a bit like this one, and basically, to cut a long story short, I became convinced and became a Christian. But at that point, I became one of the people that the modern secularist says that you can't be. I became a both-and person, whereas the secular world is always urging us that it must be either-or. When I say both-and, I mean both a Christian now and also a scientist, or at least a science student. And you're not supposed to be able to combine those, are you? Because people say either you can be, if you want to be, you can be religious if that's your thing. You know, if you're into stained glass windows and organ music, which I wasn't, and you like to close your eyes and imagine something that would be lovely without evidence, then okay, fine, fair enough. Or you could be a rational person who's interested in evidence and science. But you've got to choose. You couldn't do both. I became a both and, well, I still don't particularly like stained glass or organs, but I became both a Christian and a scientist. And, okay, I mean, I was an average Cambridge science undergraduate, so big deal. But it turns out that there's other much more eminent scientists who were also both and people. Maybe we'll do a bit of audience participation to test your knowledge of the history of science. So you've got to tell me what some of these people were famous for discovering. Okay, we'll start with an easy one. Isaac Newton. Gravity, very good. Michael Faraday. Yeah, I said electricity, and then I was rebuked recently by a friend. He's a professor of physics. He said, actually, strictly speaking, it was electromagnetic induction, but I think electricity. Electricity for us. Charles Babbage. Computer, yeah, the first mechanical computer. You can see his difference engine number 2, a replica of it in the Science Museum. Louis Pasteur. Pasteurization, bacteria, that kind of thing. That's excellent. I was once giving this talk and I said Pasteur and someone said milk, but He didn't invent milk, but he hypothesized that the reason that milk goes off is because of organisms too small to be seen by the naked eye. And at that stage, there was no physical evidence for them, but he conjectured there could be very, very small organisms, which you now know as bacteria. All of those people, the greatest scientists of their day in all sorts of different fields, and committed believers in God. Interestingly, there might be a tighter connection between the two than that. You might say, well, that's just the age they lived in, you know, in the 17th, 18th centuries. People tended to be Christians. But according to one historian of science, Sir Alfred North Whitehead, actually there's a tighter connection than that. He said it was because of the prevailing worldview of Christianity that science got started. He puts it this way. He said, mankind sought for law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. In other words, if people had believed back then, as some people today believe, that the world is entirely accidental, it's just a chance accident, it's questionable whether people would have gone to so much trouble trying to understand something they expected to be random. People in the 17th, 18th century didn't expect things to be random. They expected things to be purposefully designed by a creator God. You may not disagree with their expectation, but that arguably is why they set about trying to understand the universe in an intelligible way. Now, okay, you might say, that's a long time ago. What about more recently? I've done a little write-up of this talk that I'm trying to get published, and obviously Andrew Satch is not a famous scientist, so I thought I'll ask some of my senior scientist friends who actually are, you know, have got serious scientific positions, whether they'd write on the back cover, you know, this booklet is okay. So I wrote to one of my friends who's now the professor of materials science at Imperial College. He was a year below me, a year above me at Cambridge, but everybody knew that he was unusually sharp. I remember when I was doing my PhD, actually, I was singing in the university choir, and there was a physicist in the choir, one of the professors of physics, and I said to him, I'm going to see my friend in Cambridge this weekend, a guy called Peter Haynes, but you won't know him, he's just a PhD student. At which point this professor raised his eyebrows and said, Peter Haynes, oh yes, we know about him. And very sharp guy, was a professor in his 30s, now head of department, committed Christian. One of my friends is the reader in evolutionary genomics at Queen Mary University, and a Christian. Another one of my friends is the professor of computer science at Cambridge University and a Christian. It's interesting, isn't it? Because people say, well, of course, you can't believe in the Bible because of all the fossils. When I first became a Christian, I went to church my first Sunday and sat next to somebody with a professorial-looking beard. And it turned out he was a professor. And he was Professor Bob White, professor of geophysics at the University of Cambridge. Meanwhile, my next-door neighbour in college was supervised by Professor Simon Conway Morris, Professor of Paleontology, dinosaur expert, fossils expert. People say you can't believe in the Bible because of the fossils, but strangely, two men who know more about fossils than anyone else in this room, I suspect, seem to be able to be both and people. You can't believe in the Bible, people say, because of genetics and evolution. My friend, who's a reader in evolutionary genomics, thinks differently. I'm not saying that every successful scientist is a Christian. Of course not. There's lots of famously atheistic scientists. But it doesn't seem to be an easy either or. There's too many both and people. And I want to suggest this evening that is because there is nothing about science which contradicts the claims of Christianity. There is nothing in science that contradicts the claims of Christianity. That's my bold claim today. Of course, you've got to be careful about the way you define science. It's possible to define science atheistically, so the only explanations that you count as being scientific presuppose an atheist worldview. That's just you smuggled in your conclusion at the beginning. But if you're objective about science, I mean, what is science? Science is basically a methodology whereby you observe the world, you formulate a hypothesis to describe what you observe, and then through a series of experiments, you try to falsify or confirm that hypothesis. There's nothing about that method that means you've got to be an atheist to use it, which is why in laboratories, when Christian scientists or Muslim scientists or Hindu scientists do the experiments, you don't have to say on your scientific paper, beware, this experiment was done by a Christian or by a Hindu. I mean, we just share the same methodologies. We can all do that. I don't think the methodology is itself intrinsically atheistic, nor do I know anything that has been discovered by that scientific methodology that contradicts the claims of the Bible. That's my suggestion tonight. But you're thinking, but in that case, how come there is obviously such a huge conflict? My suggestion is, actually, the conflict is not between science and the Christian faith, but it's a conflict between two different philosophies, two different worldviews, two different belief systems. That is, there is a conflict between the philosophy of atheism or naturalism, as it's sometimes called, on the one hand, and Christianity on the other. And sometimes people want to pretend that science is automatically on the atheist side. I think that's cheating, and a bit cheeky, frankly. Let's step back from the science and investigate these two views of the world, and then do what a serious scientist ought to do and ask which one makes most sense of the evidence. That's the plan for the next, however much time we've got left, 20 minutes or so. So firstly, I'm going to define naturalism, atheism, as the philosophy that says that matter and chance are all that there is. So in the words of Bertrand Russell, the great British philosopher, mankind is nothing but a chance collocation of atoms on a minor speck of interstellar dust. Memorable way of putting it. Now, as a scientist, I agree with him that we are comprised of atoms, and I agree with him that the Earth is a relatively small planetary body in a not especially significant solar system on the edge of one of many, many galaxies. But for Bertrand Russell, the key words are, we are nothing but that. We are reducible to that. Matter and chance is all that there is. Or if you want to go slightly more depressing, you've got to go across the channel and meet the French existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre. He said, we said it in French, but translated into English, he said, every living being was born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. Can't imagine. I know, it's bleak, isn't it? I don't imagine he was a lot of fun at a dinner party. We arrived accidentally, we'll die accidentally, and the only reason we perpetuate our miserable existence is because we're too weak to face up to it and do anything about it. Or in my own field of neuroscience, Francis Crick, who shared the Nobel Prize for working out the double helical structure of DNA, went on to do neuroscience later in his career. He wrote in his book, The Astonishing Hypothesis, he puts in inverted commas because he's not sure how much the concept of personhood really makes sense, but the apparent you, your joys and your sorrows, your personal ambitions, your sense of free will, are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Now, as a neuroscientist, I agree with him that your thoughts have to do with the movement of electrons in your brain. But again, the key words are no more than. That is all that is to be said about a human being. We are reducible to our chemical constituents and the states of electrons in our brains. That's all. Now, that view of the world, I don't want to suggest it. I don't think it's automatically scientific. It's not an experiment hasn't been done to show you that that's all there is. It's a faith position. It's a philosophy. It's a worldview that some people bring to their science, or people think it's the best framework in which to understand their science. Atheism. I'm going to call it a belief system, which will really upset people like Richard Dawkins. He's always playing the game, by the way, of talking about faith as everyone over there. So all of those people believe things, whereas I'm objective. And I think that's cheating. Because it's interesting how many times in a book like The God Delusion, he'll make assertions for which he doesn't give scientific evidence. Actually, it's a very creedal kind of book. It's a book of beliefs. It just happened to be atheistic beliefs rather than Christian beliefs. So that's atheism and naturalism on the one hand. Christianity, on the other hand, I want to take, to explain the Christian alternative, I want to take an excerpt from a speech given by one of Jesus' first followers, the Apostle Paul, in first century Athens. Now, Athens was the intellectual capital of the day. it was where the greatest minds met to debate the best ideas. And we're told in particular that Paul got speaking to some Stoic and Epicurean philosophers. If you know anything about Epicureanism, you'll know that they believed that the gods were so remote that they played no role in human life. Life was essentially random, and there was no survival beyond death. And into that context, you know, the context's a little bit like modern-day naturalism. This is how Paul explains the Christian alternative. I'm just going to read you a very short excerpt, and I'm going to stop at several points during it. Here it is. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all humankind life and breath and everything. Just one sentence in, or two sentences in, I wonder if you can see that in some ways these worldviews are opposites of one another. Let me explain. If you said to an atheist like Richard Dawkins, does God exist? He would say no, or actually he'd say probably not, which I think is just a more sophisticated way of saying no. I mean, it's functionally no. If you said to Dawkins, but does Christianity exist? He'd say, well, of course. I mean, I'm not ignorant about this global phenomenon where more than a billion people worship somebody called Jesus Christ. You know, I know about that. Well, Richard Dawkins, can you please explain where Christianity came from? Of course. People made it up, he'd say. So according to the atheist, randomness produces human beings. We're an accident, a lucky throw in the cosmic lottery. And then human beings produce God. So chance produces us, our brains, by chance, think up this idea of a deity or a higher being. God is our creation. We are chance's, randomness's creation. That's the atheist worldview. And the Christian worldview is exactly the opposite. And we are God's invention. He dreamt us up. He himself is not random. He's a person with real thoughts and intentions. He dreamt us up and made us and gives us life and breath and everything. So two really opposite theories of the world. Which one makes most sense? I'm going to compare them in three ways and then I'm done. Okay, so firstly, first one's the longest, so don't panic if it takes a long time. The first one is design. I'm aware that's a very controversial word. Secondly, human purpose. Thirdly, the person of Jesus Christ in history. That's where we're going. Firstly, design. Which one makes most sense of design? Now, of course, not everyone agrees that the world is designed. According to atheists like Richard Dawkins, the world just has the appearance of design. But everyone at least agrees that intuitively, this doesn't look very random. The astronomer Sir Fred Hoyle once said that he thought the idea of life as we know it emerging by chance from a primordial slunge was intrinsically sort of unlikely. He said it's a bit like saying that a whirlwind passed through a junkyard and left behind it a fully assembled functioning 747 aircraft. I mean, it's theoretically possible that all the bits of the junkyard should just happen to blow together so that the rivets sort of blew into the hulls and, you know, and in such a way as you could start it up and fly to America. But that, if you saw a 747, that wouldn't be your first theory about how it got there, right? But according to Dawkins, we have a ready answer for this problem. Why does the world look designed when in fact there is no designer? Oh, it's because of evolution. So here's a quote from his book, The Blind Watchmaker. He says this, design, inverted commas, design is only apparent. We have a mechanism to account for it. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process, which we now know is the explanation for the existence of and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind, no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is that of the blind watchmaker. End quote. So in other words, this process of natural selection, evolution, is blind, is unconscious, but has tricked us into thinking that it intended and designed things. It didn't. It's just an automatic process that runs on chance and comes up with complexity. That's the answer that Dawkins would give. And I want to take issue with that because even if you accept that natural selection is all that you need to get from a single-celled ancestor billions of years ago to a conscious human being sitting in this room, even if you accept that, and it's worth saying, I'm skeptical about that at various points. I mean, that goes much further than anything that's been remotely demonstrated in a laboratory. But even if you do accept that, you still got a problem, because even in order to get evolution started, you have to have organisms capable of passing on their characteristics to their children in an accurate way. And to do that, you need, at minimum, an information-carrying, self-replicating molecule like DNA or RNA, which are two of the most complex molecules known to chemistry. And you have to have, on that RNA, the information capable of building even the simplest self-replicating cell, which is not very simple. Even before you can have evolution, you can't say, oh, evolution solves it, yeah. But to get that started, there's all of this molecular mechanics that you need in place. And actually, your problems get worse, because not only do you need DNA or RNA with information on it, in a basic cell capable of passing on genetic information to its children, you also have to have a universe for that to exist in. And this here, the problems really get troublesome for the naturalist. I'm going to give you two arguments why the universe is a problem for the atheist. The first one is that it exists at all. I want to give you an argument that's known as the Kalam cosmological argument. It sounds like something out of a comic strip, doesn't it? Kapow and Kalam. Anyway, this is Kalam, K-A-L-A-M, cosmological argument. And it simply says this, that everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe must have a cause. Very simple argument. Basically, let me put it in my own words. You don't have to explain things that don't change. So if you were to ask, you know, how come that microphone is still there? That's not a very interesting scientific question. I mean, it's there because it was there. And it's still there because nothing's happened to it. So it's a non-question, right? Whereas, if the microphone went over there, it's probably going to upset the sound guys, okay. Then how come there's now, at the beginning of the talk, I distinctly remember there's a microphone on each stool, and now there's two microphones on that stool? That is an interesting question. If someone said, oh no, I think it just happened, that wouldn't be a very persuasive answer. I want an explanation for it. I don't have to explain things that don't change, but I do want an explanation for something that has changed. Okay, now here's the argument. People used to think that the universe always existed. They thought the universe was eternal, up until relatively recently, 100 years or so ago, a bit less. People thought the universe was eternal. If the universe has always been here, you don't have to explain why it's here. How come the universe is here? Well, it's here because it was here. How come the microphone's on the stool? It's on the stool because it was on the stool. It's not an interesting question. But now the consensus in the scientific community is that the universe didn't used to be there and now is there. Something's changed. And you've got to ask the question, why? Why did it go from not a universe to a universe? What made the Big Bang go bang? This is a real problem for the atheist. The universe can't cause itself. Something external to it has to go bang. I think it fits absolutely with the Christian view that there is a God who decided to make a universe, and there wasn't one, and now there is. Then somebody asks, well, but you just moved the question back a step, because then the question is, well, who made God? Where did he come from? And the answer is, well, God's always been there. You don't have to explain something that hasn't changed. He's here because he was there, and he was there because he was there before that. But the universe has a beginning in time. You've got to explain why. That's a headache for the atheist. Not only that, but it turns out that the Big Bang, if you accept that theory, gives even more problems for the atheists, because the universe seems to have gone bang at exactly the correct speed. And there's a whole load of other numbers that work out just right for our existence to be possible. So a guy called Alan Guth, he was the author of The View of Inflation, the most popular theory of what happened at the beginning of the universe. Not a Christian, he's a mainstream atheistic scientist. He calculates that the expansion rate of the universe just after the Big Bang has got to be accurate to within one part in 10 to the 40. If the universe expanded too quickly, then all you would get would be hydrogen atoms, the smallest atom, with billions of miles between every atomic nucleus. So just like a very low density gas, almost a vacuum. If the universe expanded too slowly, then gravity would get the better of it. It would go bang and then get sucked back in on itself under its own gravity, crunch, and you'd have a universe and then no universe again, even before you got to 1 millisecond on your stopwatch. To have a universe with stuff bigger than hydrogen, you know, like planets and stuff, and for it to last longer than a millisecond, the fine-tuning of the speed at which it went bang has got to be accurate to within 1 part in 10 to the 40. 1 in 10 with 40 zeros on the end. Yeah, this is quite a lot worse than your chances at the Euro Millions, right? So if you want an analogy, if you took a 5-penny piece and then you tessellated 5-penny pieces across the surface of the continent of America, North America, and then you stacked them to a height of the distance between here and the moon, 380,000 kilometers away, and then you did the same for 1 billion other continents the same size and painted one of them red with nail varnish and blindfolded your mum and asked her to pick one at random, that's about 1 in 10 to the 40. In other words, it's very, 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 etc., unlikely. And the explanation, it just happened, doesn't seem like a very responsible scientific theory. You know, that's too lucky. Actually, the most popular theory now is to say, well, we accept the numbers are just crazily small. So maybe there was infinitely many universes, because the idea is if you do the experiment infinitely many times, one of them's going to get lucky, right? So maybe we live in a multiverse where every possible universe exists. Well, okay, but let's just be clear about what we're doing here. We're not now doing science, because the multiverse can't be observed or tested or repeated. I mean, this isn't a scientific theory. It's a faith position. The numbers are really ridiculous. By faith, I choose to believe in a multiverse to explain it. Okay. But be clear about what you're doing at that point. You're just taking a leap in the dark. And quite a problematic one, I think. If your explanation is that every possible universe exists, and therefore this one isn't very surprising, I mean, just think of the implications about that moment for your life. I mean, as well as the version of this talk where you're sitting where you are, there's the version where you're sitting the opposite way round, and I guess there is a universe somewhere where that's happening. And as well as the one in which you're scratching your chin, there's one where you're scratching your head. And in fact, every possible permutation of bits of your body you could be scratching at this moment. And as well as that universe is the universe in which I die now. He's now wishing this was the universe we were in. No. If everything is simultaneously existing, we never ask why. It's a meaningless question, because it's also why not. I think that's problematic. I wouldn't want to go easily for that faith position. Or you could explain it by saying maybe there's a God who's eternal and timeless and has always existed, who decided to make a world from nothing. And he wanted the world to be populated with human beings. And so he made the Big Bang go bang at exactly the right speed. And he created DNA and put on the DNA exactly the information he wanted to encode for the kind of creatures that he designed to populate the Earth. It's a Christian view. I think it makes quite a good fit for the scientific data. I think atheism makes a worse fit. So design, number one. Number two, more briefly. Which one makes most sense of human experience? I don't know if you've ever come across the philosopher John Gray. He's quite popular in Waterstone, sort of bestseller a few years ago. He used to be the professor of European thought at the LSE. I think probably quite a lot of you are King students, in which case that's an enemy institution. But anyway, popular British philosopher, wrote a book called Straw Dogs, in which he chastises atheists for failing to take their beliefs through to their logical conclusion. He's not a Christian. He believes in some sort of Gaia hypothesis in the end. But he says that the trouble is, you say that you think the world's random, but you don't follow through. He says, if that were true, then we live in a world, in fact, I think he thinks it is true, it's a random world, we live in a world that is as indifferent to our sufferings as it is to our hopes and our crimes. And the point is, if the universe is random, random numbers don't care. They're indifferent to you. I mean, you care. I don't want to suffer. But fundamentally, the random numbers that are behind it don't care. And they don't care about your crimes either. I mean, good and evil are just labels that we give as social conventions to two different kinds of random numbers. I remember when I was doing my PhD, I used to get a hard time for being the gullible Christian. You know, they were in a kind of good-natured, bantery kind of way, but they always used to tease me at coffee time. And I remember one day I said to Kate, who was one of the professors, I said, look, Kate, tell me if your philosophy is right, why, I should explain, this was for the sake of argument in a banter kind of situation. Kate said, for the sake of argument, why would killing you be wrong? Sounds quite creepy now, doesn't it? But thought experiment, why would it be any different to cutting a grapefruit in half for my breakfast? Because all I'd be doing in both cases is rearranging the atoms of the universe in a slightly different way. Kate atoms, grapefruit atoms, I mean, much the same proportion of carbon, etc. And she thought about it for a moment, and she said her comeback was, well, the difference is my mother would be upset. And then I pushed it and said, but Kate, what's upset? Because upset is just the decrease in the concentration of serotonin in the randomly assembled collection of atoms, which is your mother's brain. I mean, why does that matter? I wasn't trying to humiliate her, but I said, look, why does that matter? Because of course it did matter. I mean, Kate's a really nice lady. I mean, we got on really well, and she cares about people, right? She was very kind to me. But the point is that the philosophy that says at rock bottom this is just matter doesn't account for our sense that it does matter. I think there's a sort of mismatch, there's an inconsistency there. One of the things I used to hate about Christians as an atheist, I used to hate hypocrisy. You know, people turning up at church on Sunday looking religious and then living the same as everybody else the rest of the week. In fact, sometimes worse than everyone else. I hated that. And if you hate religious hypocrisy, you're in good company, because Jesus Christ could not stand it. His fiercest rebukes are for religious people who are two-faced. He hated it. I never realized as an atheist that I was a hypocrite, because I was saying this is my view of the world and I was living as though that wasn't true. My life is significant. Good and evil matters. Hopes and aspirations are worth something. And it didn't line up. Whereas according to the Christian view, there is a God who made us, and our sense that human life matters is correct. It does matter. There's a better fit for the data. I want to read on a bit further in Paul's speech in Athens. He says, the God who made the world and everything in it, we saw, he gives to all people life and breath and everything. He made every nation of mankind in order that they should seek God in the hope they might feel their way towards him and find him. I think that is an extraordinary idea. We're not just talking about God as a first cause, as the one who pressed the button to make the universe start. This is describing God as a person whose intention was that human beings know him personally. That's what we're for. That's what he designed us for. That's what he wanted from us. He wanted a relationship with us. Now, at this point, you realize that science is kind of out of its depth. Science is very powerful, but science cannot tell you everything that's important. So I had a chance to, debate would be too strong because he was a speaker and I was just asking questions, but I got a chance to put a few questions to Peter Atkins, who's a professor in Oxford, he's an atheist, outspoken atheist, and he was arguing at this symposium that I was at last autumn that a rational person should only accept things that have been proved by scientific experiments. And I thought this was a bizarre thing to say. And so really cheekily, I put my hand up and said, excuse me, Professor Atkins, can you tell us who was speaking at the podium before you were? And of course he could, because you know, we were all there and we all saw it. And he said, well, it's so-and-so. And I said, but I find that we are unable to verify that by an experiment that we could perform. There's no experiment you could do to check that. I mean, you could find the guy's DNA at the top on the podium, perhaps, but that doesn't tell you when he was there in sequence. But actually, we had 300 people, and they all knew that that was true. Because, of course, there's kinds of evidence other than empirical evidence, eyewitness evidence, that kind of thing. So I just thought that was a really odd claim to make. You really only accept things that you do an experiment on? I don't think that's true. But when it comes to relationships, experiments are even more limited, aren't they? So let's suppose you wanted to get to know me, but all you had to go on was what you could work out by a scientific experiment. Here I am, you know, you can run some tests. What could you discover? Well, you could do gas chromatography under my armpits and work out what deodorant I'm wearing and whether it's coping with a slightly stressful situation in which I find myself. You could do DNA fingerprinting and work out whether I'm wanted by Interpol or whether I am likely to die early from any known genetic illness, and I am. I've got a history of heart disease on my father's side. It's about all. I mean, you wouldn't be able to tell almost anything of importance to getting to know me as a person. You couldn't tell my name. You couldn't tell who I love. You couldn't tell what causes I would die for. I mean, you know, really important things you just wouldn't have any access to. It's not that science isn't powerful. I mean, by all means, let's use science. It just can't tell us everything that's important, which is why I very much doubt if you're in a relationship, you just said on your first date, excuse me, can I please take a small DNA sample and I'll run some tests. I'll be back with the decision in a couple of weeks. It just doesn't work like that. If you want to get to know a person, you've got to meet the person and find out what they're like. And science just can't get you that far. I mean, how could you find out what God was like just by science? You couldn't even run the experiment, could you? I need a control. God, please, can you leave the universe for a moment and we'll see whether the readings vary. I mean, you can't do that. And we would be stuck, except that the Bible says that God has taken the initiative to make himself known personally to us. And I'm going to read the last little bit of this and then we're going to be done. Paul says to the Athenians, we shouldn't think that God is like a man-made image made of gold or silver or something like that. He's not a figment of our imagination. He's not our creation. Actually, God commands people to turn from such ignorance because he's fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he's appointed, and of this he's given proof by raising him from the dead. When they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some scoffed, but others said, we want to hear more about this. And maybe there'll be the same reactions in this room, who knows? God has set a day when he'll judge the world. He's given proof of this by raising a man from the dead. Now, this was a huge shock to me, looking into Christianity as an undergraduate, to find a word like proof or evidence or reason in the Bible. I just thought the Bible was saying, close your eyes, dream up fairies, and believe in a world that you'd like to be true, even though it's make-believe. And to discover that the Bible was not saying that, it was saying, here are reasons and evidence and proof on which you should base your view of the world. And in particular, Paul says that the proof is the resurrection of Jesus. Some scoffed at it, others said, tell us more, tell us more. Now, I looked up the resurrection in the God Delusion, Richard Dawkins' magnum opus on science and faith, in the index, and he mentions the resurrection only twice. And that's to say that it either happened or didn't happen. So I agree with one of those two. And then he says, it didn't happen because by its very nature, it would contradict the laws of science. And I think that's very telling because that is not actually how science works. You don't decide your theory and then reject the evidence that doesn't fit it. You check the evidence that doesn't fit it and then you revise your theory. I think what Richard Dawkins is saying actually is not that the laws of physics make it impossible, but the presuppositions of atheism make it impossible. You see, if this world is random, if all that there is matter and chance and the laws that we've observed that describe it, I guess it is pretty unlikely. It's difficult to work out how a dead person could come back from the dead. I mean, that would be I guess you could say it seems unlikely, according to my presuppositions. But what if those presuppositions are wrong? And actually, I wonder if you're even open to the possibility this evening. I wonder if you think, well, maybe there could be a different view of the world that is, you know, maybe there could be a God, I don't know if there is, but I can conceive of there being a God who was powerful enough to create this world and form it and shape it and give us life and breath and everything. And I guess if he really wanted to get to know people, I suppose he could have come as a human being and made himself known in the person of Jesus Christ. And I guess I'd expect him in that case to do something to prove to us that he wasn't just a con man or another religious teacher. And I mean, really good proof, the kind of proof that no other human being could ever do, because it would mess with the ordinarily observed laws of biology, like a resurrection. It's conceivable. Was there a resurrection? You see, you can either decide a priori that there wasn't, because your faith in atheism tells you there wasn't. Or you could look at the evidence objectively. And if there was a resurrection, then Paul says you've got to get rid of these ideas. They're ignorant and wrong. Because it's proof that there is a God who made us, who wants to know us, who's come in the person of Jesus Christ to deal with our sins, to reconcile us to himself. And this is proof on the basis of which we should change our mind. Well, I changed my mind many years ago. I've spoken about it for a very long time, so thank you for your attention. I think we're going to take a pause, and then after the pause, you can ask questions. Is that right? Do you want to tell us what's next?